So it was a few weeks ago whenever all of our students were off at a church camp. My wife, she went as well as a volunteer. And for the very first time in my life, I was sick and all alone. Now, you can go all if you want to or not. I don't really care. But, I got married at 21 years old. So I lived in mom and dad's house till I got married. And then we got married, moved in together. The very first time that I have ever been sick and all alone. And I'm not talking like man flu, okay? I was like really sick. I had about 104 fever on that Monday night, and I thought I was going to die. Like literally. I mean, I might be a little dramatic there, but I was like waking up gasping in the middle of the night, all the drainage and all the crud and all those things. Just, it was miserable, shivering, teeth chattering, you name it. I had it going on, and I was all by myself. And so I actually thought that my theory as to why I believe dogs are better than cats was going to be tested. Because here is my theory. My theory is that if I were to die alone in my house, my dogs would just cuddle up next to me and just lay there until somebody came and found me. A cat, you take a nap and a cat will start nibbling on you going, "You dead yet?" You know, because it'll want to take you out. And so I'm going to be alone in my house for like 5 days. We're going to find out, are my dogs actually going to eat me, you know? And so it was an awful night. And I don't know if you wear one, but I wear like a fitness tracker just to kind of keep an eye on my stress, my sleep, my heart rate, all those other kind of things. And so every morning I wake up and it'll give me a recovery score and tell me like how well I am and those kind of things. And so on that Tuesday morning, I woke up. Up and I look at my recovery score and it was 1 out of 100. Okay. And I kid you not, it had a skull and crossbones next to it. Right. So I was like, not dead, just almost dead. Right. You know, just kind of like there. And so it just kind of cracked me up. And I was thinking about it, about how we've got these trackers and these things. And I don't know, like your watch or anything like that, but we can like get down to like how many steps we take a day, what our heart rate is, the exertion levels that we are doing, how recovered we are. I mean, we've got all these kind of things that can like track our physical health and how well we are doing and give us a score at the end or at the beginning at every single day. But whenever it comes to something like, you know, my relational health, there is no tracker for that. There is nothing in anything, in any bit of software that I have that is going to tell me how loved I am or how well I am doing at loving others, how important the relationships are around me. And it just feels like, well, that feels like a little of an important thing to kind of know. How well am I doing relationally? Am I loved and am I loving others well? And really, that's where Paul is in Romans chapter 12. Well, these few verses that we're going to look at today, I think we're looking at four verses today, they kind of act as a relational health tracker and can help us kind of understand our relational score on how well we are loved and how well we are doing at loving other people. And so if you've got your Bible, let's get open to Romans chapter 12, verses 9 through 13. You just heard them read there. But Paul really is going to kind of help us to understand what is kind of going on in our relationships right now. Now, remember, last couple of weeks, Josh kicked us off into Romans chapter 12. If you're new to Corinth, we are in the book of Romans for almost the entire year, just working through it. And the first 11 chapters of Romans is like theology, you know, information. And then, as Josh said, in chapter 12, you really do kind of take the tassel and put it onto the other side. And now it is here. What do you do with this? And so he's laying a foundation. You know, what does it look like to offer yourself as a living sacrifice? What does it look like to not conform to the world, but to be transformed by the renewing of your mind? What does it look like to be a part of a family to where everybody is using their gifts and their skills for the benefit of others? What does it look like? And that's where verse 9 just kind of jumps to the screen here. And it says this: so don't just pretend to love others, really love them. Hate what is wrong, hold tightly to what is good. Do not pretend to love others, but really love them. Now, that word, don't pretend to love them, what the word that Paul is using there is it's for the word hypocrite. Okay? It really, what it says is have anti-hypocritical love is where he is. Don't play act. Don't pretend. I think that the greatest example of play acting love comes from the life of Jesus. It's the last night before his crucifixion. And if you remember the scene is that he and a few of his buddies have gone off into the garden to pray before he is going to be betrayed. And they keep falling asleep on him, wakes him up. And then the last time he says, "Wake up because my betrayer is here." And who is it? It's Judas Iscariot. He leads the soldiers and the teachers of the law to Jesus. And what was the sign that Judas gave those people that this was who Jesus was? He was going to betray him with a kiss. That is play-acting love. It wasn't real affection. It was fake. It was pretend. And Paul says that's not the way that our love is supposed to be. Don't pretend to love people. Really love them. I mean, that is the command that is going to overlay the rest of this chapter, all the way through verse 21, actually. This is what this is. The command is, don't pretend. Don't pretend to love people. Your love must be sincere. It's got to be genuine. And everything that follows is just detail and on how we do it. And what we'll see is he's going to give us 10 commands. He just barks them out now. I mean, it's just like a coach just yelling at his team of like, do this, do that, do this. I mean, he's just barking commands out, 10 of them. First thing he says, what if we're going to be, you know, genuinely loving and not pretending, then we've got to hate what is wrong. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm sitting here reading through this, and it's like, let your love be genuine, don't pretend that loving, and then hate. And it's like, whoa, buddy, can we just like calm down for just a second? Because like, what do you mean that love and hate can go together at the same time? And I think we struggle with it because in our culture, we've taken that word love and we have equated it with the word tolerance and tolerate. You do you. You have your truth. You go do your truth. If it works for you, that's great. And so I will tolerate you and I will love you no matter what. No judgment here. But that's not what the Bible teaches about love. That's not what love means. In fact, that word hate, it means we shudder with horror. We loathe it. We cannot stand it. We are repulsed by evil, is what Paul is saying. Maybe this will help you get your brain around it. I want you to imagine that it's breakfast time, or maybe it's after dinner time, and it's cereal time for you. And so you go and you get your bowl, not like a little bowl, I'm talking the salad bowl, and you fill it up with Honey Nut Cheerios or Cheerios, Frosted Wheat, Mini Wheat, Reese's Puffs, Lucky Charms, whatever it is that you want to go with that just, you know, makes you just like, oh man, this is it. And then you go to the refrigerator and you grab the cow's milk, not almond milk, none of that nonsense. Give me the cow milk right there. And you get ready to, and you start pouring it into that cereal bowl and it comes out in clumps. See, now you know what that word hate means, all right? Because that feeling is the exact feeling that Paul is trying to emote. It is, we are repulsed by it. And it's like, oh my gosh, that's just disgusting. I didn't want cottage cheese in my cereal. We're repulsed by it. And he says, genuine love is repulsed by evil. Let's make a clarifier. Is repulsed by what evil does. Not who does it. But we're repulsed by what evil does because we see the damage. We see the cost. We see what it does. And whenever we see what evil does, we shudder. And we just like, oh my goodness. So real love is this morally discerning love that we know the difference between right and wrong. Because we hate what is evil and we embrace what builds up. We are glued to what is good. Verse 10, he says, so love each other with genuine affection and take delight in honoring each other. Now, that word love there, if you want to circle it off to the side, it's the word for brotherly love. It's the word for familial love. It's the love that we have as a parent for our kids or for our grandkids or great-grandkids. It's just that love that we just have. Like, you know, whenever you held your baby for the very first time, your heart just went, and it just expanded in love. And you looked at that little alien lizard thing right there in your arms, blue, covered in glue. Like, oh my goodness, there's never been a more perfect thing on the planet than this. Why? If somebody were to say, why do you love them? What would your answer be? Because they belong to us. Like for us, we just got to experience this for the past couple of weeks. We've been out of town, and we've been out of town the last couple of Sundays because our daughter was in the process of giving birth to our very first grandbaby. After 36 hours of labor and two failed epidurals, Haven Ruth made her way into the world on Monday, July 20th. And I think we got some pictures there of the little girl. And guys, I've had people tell me for years now, if they would have known having grandkids was this much fun, that's where they would have started. And I get it now. I really do. And listen, the very first moment that I held her, it was just love. And here's the thing. I've held a lot of babies over the years. I didn't love them like this one. Why? Because she's ours. She's our blood. And as crazy as it sounds, y'all, you just got to get this through your skulls. Paul says that's the kind of love that we're supposed to cultivate for one another, for the family of God, for people in this church, the people that you're sitting next to, the people that are sitting behind you, the people that you're going to see in the concourse after service, even the person who's going to cut you off in the parking lot to try to get around a speed bump, okay? That person, you cultivate that brotherly love and that familial love for them. Why? Well, because the church is a family, not a club. And that's just the way it was always meant to be. See, in a club, we ask the question, so what do I get from this? What are the benefits for me? But in a family, we don't ask that. In a family, it's like, well, what do I need to bring? What do you need from me? Because that's what a family does. See, you have been born into a family. You did not join a club whenever you became a Christian. Jesus uses the word that you will be born again. That means you enter into a brand new family. You didn't join a club like I joined Planet Fitness a couple of years ago, and where I've got my little app that tells me everything that I'm entitled to, that I get to use the weights, I get to bring a friend, just one, and then I get to do a massage chair if I want to do all those other kind of things. I go to that place thinking, what do I get out of here? But whenever it comes to being a Turner, or whenever it comes to being a part of the family of God, it's not what do I get out of this? It's what do I need to bring? And I know when it comes to my family, I need to bring provision. I need to bring support. I need to bring pursuit. I've got to bring all these things to my family, because that's what you do in a family. And that's Paul's point. We love each other as we are brothers and sisters, because it is a family. It's not a club. So what does that mean? That means we take delight in honoring each other. The word that he uses there is, it's actually a competition word. He says in other translations, we'll put it like this, outdo one another whenever it comes to honor. It is a competitive sport in the church whenever it comes to honoring each other in the family of God. And this is so weird, man, because in the world, we compete for honor. We push people down. We climb over them. We use them as stepping stones so that we can receive honor. But in the church, we're different. We race to give honor away. We delight in it because it is not about winning the spotlight for yourself, but it's putting somebody else in the spotlight before they beat you to it. That's the way it works. Like I'm sure you've all said in meetings before, whenever you're trying to celebrate wins and you're trying to brag on somebody and you start to brag on them and she goes, oh, it wasn't that big of a deal. It wasn't that big of a deal. It was nothing. And whenever it comes to delighting in honor, competing in honor, what do? Then we jump in. We go, I understand what she's trying to say, but you need to listen to me. She's downplaying this because she killed it. She was awesome. Listen to some of the things that she did. And we just brag on them and brag on them and we brag on them. Because in the church, we don't hoard honor. We chase each other down to give it away. We outdo one another whenever it comes to giving honor. Verse 11, we're never be lazy, but work hard. Serve the Lord enthusiastically. Lazy means don't be lagging behind. And so it's like whenever your kids are playing online games and you got the Wi-Fi going in the house, happened in our house growing up, whenever my kids were growing up all the time. They'd be online playing a game, and then all of a sudden I'd hear, Dad, the Wi-Fi. The Wi-Fi's lagging. I just got killed. You know, and it's like, fix the Wi-Fi. You know, and you hear all these things because everybody knows that just like a half second of delay in those online games is the difference between, you know, your guy, you know, being able to win and your guy being respawned in some other location, right? And so that's what it is. That's the picture. It's lagging. It's behind. He says, don't be lagging behind. In other words, it's not a dramatic failure. It's not that the internet went out. It's that there's a lag in the system now. And so don't be lazy. Doesn't mean that you've done a dramatic, I walked away from Jesus or any of those things. It is just this. You're slow. You're technically connected, but you're not effective. And he says, don't do that. Don't be lazy. Don't be lagging behind, but work hard. Why? Who are you actually working for? You are serving the Lord enthusiastically with great enthusiasm. It's the picture of boiling water on the stove. It's getting fired up for something that costs you service, sacrifice, generosity, and it's service for the Lord. Not so that people will notice you, but it's for Him. Because if you're on fire for people to see it, you're going to cool off the moment you're in an empty room. But if you're on fire because it's for Him, it doesn't matter the size of the room or if there's anybody there. We work hard. That's what he says. Verse 12, rejoice in our confident hope, be patient in trouble, and keep on praying. This isn't just crossing our fingers. This is certainty because we know that God is faithful. We know He's going to do what He said that He would do. We know that He's going to come through, and that is our anchor. That is that hope, and that hope changes how we are able to endure our hardship and the difficulties that we go through. We're able to stand our ground with endurance in the midst of testing and difficulty. A couple of weeks ago, whenever we were back home, we were at Mom and Dad's house, and Dad had the remote control, and he was going through YouTube looking for non-AI videos to watch. He struggles with that, okay? And somehow we ended up on the 1964 fight between Cassius Clay and Sonny Liston. That was number one, all right? Liston Clay, number one. So Cassius Clay became Muhammad Ali, if you don't know that. And this incredible fight, and I don't know if you remember this fight or not, but Muhammad Ali was in control for the first four rounds, just bopping and just taking care of this dude. And then something got in his eye in round four. Nobody knows what it was. Some people think Sonny Liston put some stuff on his glove. Some people think it might have just been the ointment from the blood. And just anyway, he could not see. And so he's sitting over on his stool before round five, and he tells his trainer, I ain't going back out there. I just quit. Take my gloves off. I don't want to do it. His trainer's like, no, I'm not doing that. He's like, you're going to get back out there. And he's like, you just go out there and you just stay away from him, right? You just stay away from him and maybe you'll be able to see again, all right? And so he's like, all right. So he just goes around there and he's just like trying to stay away from Liston the best that he can. And eventually his eyes clear out and you can see the moment when it happens. He regains control in the fifth round and in the sixth round. And then whenever the bell is rung for the seventh round to start, it's Sonny Liston who gets his gloves cut off. And he quits. Same fright, same pressure, different responses. One of them endured even though he literally could not see what was coming at him. The other one gave up just because it got hard and he got hit in the face a few times. See, being patient in trouble does not mean that you can see how it's all going to work out. It means that you're going to stand your ground anyway and you're going to stay in the fight. And he says, and keep on praying. Nonstop, don't let up. And that's not a separate item after our hope and endurance. That is the source. It is what sustains our hope and endurance. And then he says, and when God's people are in need, be ready to help them. Always be eager to practice hospitality. So there are two commands there. You guys see them. One is we're supposed to share with God's people who are in need. So what that means very simply is this. When somebody in the church is in need, you help. You sign up for the meal train. You say, hey, I'm going to help out. You show up. You do what you can. You go visit them in the hospital. You go visit them in the hospice care. We all say, I am going to make the internal health of my church family my responsibility, not somebody else's. That's what it's saying. You share with God's people who are in need. And then the second thing is you practice hospitality. This is opening the door to those outside the church. Because a family that only takes care of itself isn't really a family anymore. It becomes more of a closed club. And that's never what the church was supposed to be. And that word for practice, the word that Paul uses there, it means to chase, to hunt, to pursue. He's going to use it in verse 14 whenever he's talking about persecution and how there were enemies of Christians who were chasing them down, hunting them down, trying to take them out. That's the same word that he's using here in a positive way. He's saying you need to be on the hunt for opportunities to do good for people. You need to be on the hunt to look for ways to practice hospitality for the stranger. In other words, as Christians, we don't wait for the stranger to knock. We go looking for the stranger. We look for opportunities to practice hospitality. And I'll be honest, it's really easy to do the opposite on this one, is it not? You see that there's a new family moving into your subdivision. What is the easiest thing to do? Is you see that moving truck and you just go, "Hey there!" Then walk in your garage and shut the door and just walk away, right? That's the easiest thing to do. It's probably what most of us do. But if we're going to practice hospitality, we don't just wave. We walk over. And if you got a strong back and a weak mind, then you help move stuff in. If you don't have a strong back anymore, then you'd bake some cookies or a pie or whatever it is that you can do. Take a DoorDash card over, whatever it is. And you just show some hospitality. And that really is the twofold need of the church. We need to love our family well enough that nobody falls through the cracks. And then we need to love strangers hard enough that our family never stops growing. I love what the old preacher Ben Merrill said, one of my heroes. He said this: everybody wants to be a part of a small, friendly, evangelistic church. He said, but the problem is those churches don't exist. Because a small, friendly, evangelistic church will soon be a large, friendly, evangelistic church. It's just the way it works. Whenever we love our family well and we practice hospitality to the stranger. Paul says, don't just pretend to love others. Really love them. And he's just given us 10 ways that love shows up whenever it's the real thing. And so the question that I want to leave us with as we just kind of begin to wrap this up and start putting some legs to this, I just want to hit you with a question. And it's just this. Do you actually have people in your life that you can practice this on? And do you actually have, I'm talking in the family of God and in this church family that we're a part of, do you have people to practice these 10 things that we just went through? Do you actually have those people in your life? And I want to show you just a little tool that has helped me begin to see this clearly and just kind of begin to get my brain around this. I don't know who this is original with, so I can't give credit. My mentor gave it to me. I don't know where he stole it from. So this is stolen goods. I'll admit, this is stolen goods. But this will help you think through just this. So we'll call it the spheres of belonging, and we'll throw this up here on the screen. And so in the spheres of belonging, there are these little circles. These are in your notes if you want to scribble them down. Like First, the outer ring of it, this is the biggest group of people, is the public sphere. Okay, that's the public sphere. That's just people that are just out there that you just kind of loosely connected with. Like for me, if you don't know, I'm a huge Kansas City Chiefs fan. I'm from Southwest Missouri, not a bandwagon guy. Okay, trust me, lived through it all. And so I remember about, maybe it was eight years ago. I was in Peru on a mission trip and I was walking through this marketplace in Peru. And as I normally do, I had a Kansas City Chiefs hat on. So just walking through this marketplace, nobody speaks English or anything like that. And I end up walking past some dude and then all of a sudden I hear, "Go Chiefs!" And it's like, my people, right? You know, this is amazing. You know, it's like, even here in the Southern Hemisphere, Chiefs Kingdom is alive and it is active. And that would be the public sphere. That's like a loose connection with people. You could call it Dog Nation, where you bark at each other or whatever in the world it is that you do, right? Or the hive, you know, the Yellow Jacket hive, and you go, or whatever it is. I don't even know. Okay? But that's just this big old sphere that is out there. In the church world, we could just call it this. We'll call it the church lobby. Okay, these are people or the church parking lot. You see, you might kind of recognize them, might not. But hey, we know we've got an affiliation because we're here together. But then we move in and we get into the social sphere. And that's another layer in, okay? So it's going to be a little bit closer. So this isn't just people who wear Chiefs gear and we're Chiefs fans, or just people we see in the church lobby. These are people maybe we're a part of a Bible study with, or maybe you're in a larger Sunday school class, or a larger small group, or a big room study that is kind of going on, and you can kind of pick out faces. You've probably got their name before, but you're like, I don't remember their name, and so they're just bro, or hey, how are you? What's up, man? That's kind of what it is. So it's kind of just a social little sphere here. It's friendly. It's not intense. Kind of know them. Then we get in a little bit further and we get into the personal space. And this is where we're like, really, we get to know each other. Okay. And this is whenever, so if you're in a small group, this would be the couple or the couple of couples that you go to dinner with as well. Or you go to lunch with after church. Okay. That's who these people are. And so you sit across from a table and you are sharing with them. It's free flow. There's some private, some personal things. Okay. So these are the people that if your kid's acting like a wackadoo, they know your kid is acting like a wackadoo. All right. You share that with them. But then we get into the innermost circle, which we call the intimate. And I'm going to tell y'all, this is a small circle, probably 1 to 3 people max in this one. If you're married, your spouse should be one of them. I just want to make sure I say that out loud, okay? But it's 1 to 3 people. Gordon MacDonald, the old preacher, he calls them capital F friends. These are your friends, right? They're the ones, if you call at 3 a.m., you know that if their phone's not on silent, they're going to pick it up, okay? And they're the ones that are going to be there. These are the ones that you can honestly say, I have no secrets with them, it is well with my soul. These are the most rare of all friendships. These are the ones that we fight for and we protect at all costs. So let's leave that up there. And I want to zero in on those last two, the personal and the intimate circles. And here's, I want to ask you a question. What names would you write down in those two circles? Can you write down a name? What are the names of these people? What names are you writing down? Who is it that you can say, I have no secrets, it's well with my soul? There's nothing that is hidden from them. They know it all, the good, the bad, the ugly. There is no play acting at all going on in this relationship. Now, if a name has come to mind for you, here's what I would suggest. One, write it down. Just write it down so you just kind of got it right there. But then I would do this. I would send them a text. I would give them a call. I'd write them a note and just say, thank you. Because these are the relationships that we give gratitude for, we cultivate, and just go, you know what? I don't have very many friends like you. Paul talks about Timothy. He says, I have no one else like Timothy. Who is your no one else like? And just let him know that. Now, here at Corinth, we want to help you in finding, or at least getting you into the environments to where you are able to begin finding these kind of relationships. And I know it can be a bit of a struggle sometimes. It is a bigger church. We've got 4 services, bam, 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 right after each other. Times are tight. All kinds of things are going on. A lot of things in motion. And it's not always easy to figure out just where do I start. And so that's why we do this a couple of times a year. We have a place for you to start. It's called Rooted. All right. This is coming up here in a few weeks on Wednesday nights. And so what I would love for you to do, if you need some help finding that, Rooted is a 10-week journey that is designed to help people connect to God, connect to church, connect to others here, and help discover your purpose. And for us at Corinth, it is the on-ramp to finding community here at Corinth. So it's starting in just a few weeks. It's a Wednesday, first Wednesday in September, okay? And I would love for you to join in and be a part of that if you haven't been able to find a group or you don't have a group anymore, okay? Be a part of that. Get involved. We watch your kids. We got all kinds of things. So be a part of that. Now, if you have an objection, because an objection that sometimes we'll hear at times is like, well, I've tried being a part of the group and it just didn't work for me. It was just a bad experience. That group was awful. They, all these things. You're like, so I just don't ever want to be a part of a group again. If that's where you are, with all the pastoral empathy that I can muster, let me just say this to you. Who cares that you had a bad experience once? Because this is why I say that. You had a bad haircut once, and you just didn't give up on getting haircuts the rest of your life. You went to a bad doctor once, and you didn't go, you know what? No more doctors for me. I'm smart enough. I'll figure all this out. You had a car breakdown and you didn't go, well, that's just it. Cars are unreliable, horse and buggy for me the rest of my life. And what do? You go find a new one. And if you had a group experience that just wasn't great, I'm sorry. I really do mean. But go find a new one. Try it again. It might take you 3, 4, 5 different attempts to find your people, the group that you just clicked the best with. Don't give up on it because it is that important. Give it another shot. Now, if you're already connected, you're already in a group, and maybe then today isn't about finding your person. Maybe it's about going and being that person for somebody else. And so maybe what today is an invitation to stop sitting in a group and start leading one. And becoming and making your home or making somebody else's home, but making sure the group that you lead is that place where people can move in those circles to where they are truly known. And maybe someday they'll write your name down in that one of those center circles. But remember where we started. Don't just pretend to love others. Really love them. And here's why. Because pretending is what keeps you safe. Real love is what makes you known. And that's what we're looking for. To be truly known by someone. I remember a few years ago, we were just in the middle of this a season. You guys have had those seasons, right? I just call it the in it. We are in it kind of season. And it was everywhere. I mean, it was work, it was home, it was family, it was financial. I mean, you just name it, we were in it, right? And I remember calling my mentor, Alan, at that time, and we were just on the phone, and I'm just going through it. And I lay it all out, no secrets, just raw, right? And I remember as I got done, he goes, Adam, can I encourage you with something today? Please, I need all the encouragement that I can get, right? It's like, I want to encourage you with this. You are in the middle of an awful season. Alan, I don't think you know what encouragement means. But it is encouragement to hear sometimes somebody say, you know what, you're not crazy. You're in the middle of a difficult season. Now is not forever. There will be an end. We don't know when that is going to come, but now is not forever. But you are in the midst of a difficult season. And sometimes, don't you just need to hear from somebody, you're not insane? This is hard. He did that for me. And I remember it was probably about a few months later, and we were together, and we were going through some things, and I was going through my stuff that I was in there, just laying it all out, going through it, and, you know, just laying it all out, and I got done. And I remember he looked at me and he goes, are you done now? I remember going, yeah. He goes, good. Because my only question for you is like, where'd Adam go? Because I don't like the guy that's sitting in front of me right now. Because you're focused on your misery and you need to flip the script and get your gratitude back. And he killed me. And this man that I looked up to in the middle circle right there would say that to me. But you know what? It was the biggest gift that he could give me in that moment. Because real love costs, doesn't it? That's what we need. We need people in our lives who can affirm us and who can confront us all at the same time, whenever we need it. And today, as you're sitting here, you might be just sitting there thinking, it's like, dude, I don't have anybody like that. I don't have anybody in my life who truly knows me well enough to affirm me when I need affirmation or to confront me when I need confrontation. I don't think anybody truly knows me. And if that's how you feel, I just want to say this. There is someone who knows you. And he knows the good, the bad, the ugly. He knows the things about you that you don't even know about yourself just yet. And whenever he decided to tell you that he loved you, he didn't just send it in a message. He didn't just say it. He just didn't write it down in a book. He actually came to this planet, became like you, became like me. And he went and he died on a cross for us to show us how much he loves us and to provide us a way to be truly known, not just by each other, but by our Father in heaven. And everything that Paul lays out, that is the foundation for it all. It is not something that you have to muster up in yourself. It is something that you receive. And so today, if you are in this place and you have never received the love of Jesus, never been baptized into him, you know, today is a great day to say, I want to do that. But maybe today you're just overwhelmed, you feel alone, you feel hopeless, and you're just like, I just don't even know. Our prayer partners are going to be up here like they are every single week as we sing this song. And come on up, let them pray over you, let them pastor you, let them partner with you in this moment, because you are not alone. You are loved, dearly loved. So Father, today we are asking for your love to shine through, to break through, and help us to be absolutely certain of this one thing, that we are not alone, that we are loved by you. And so, Jesus, thank you for coming, dying in our place. Thank you for showing us what true love really looks like. And Father, please, today, whatever it is that we are carrying, help us to leave it here at your feet. And we pray it in your name, Lord Jesus. Amen.